Good day, everyone, and welcome to this chapter of The Hitchhiker's Guide to ESG, where we explore all things that may be environmental, social, and governance risks for investors. Today, we're here with Jessica McHugh, head of our media operation, and Nick Erickson from our ESG investment team to speak with Dr. Samantha Montano about our recent breasts with climate change and winter storm Uri, which proved to be a fairly significant event in the lives of every Texan, and some would say a major disaster. But before we get into our discussion today, let me tell you about Dr. Montano. Dr. Samantha Montano is an assistant professor of emergency management at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. Her educational background includes a BS in psychology from Loyola University in New Orleans, a master's of science and PhD in emergency management from North Dakota State University. Her research interests and educational experience cut across several areas of interest to emergency management, such as disaster preparedness, response, recovery, mitigation. She studies vulnerable populations in disasters and the political and legal foundations of emergency management and disaster communication. So all things about disasters. She's also the co-founder of the Center for Climate Adaption Research, which is an organization that funds research to evaluate and recommend policy to manage the effects of climate change through research, education, and advocacy. Dr. Montano is also the founder and author of the wonderfully interesting blog and newsletter, which I subscribe to, and I suggest everybody do the same that's listening, called Disasterology, where she shares her favorite disaster-related news articles, research, books, podcasts, and other things she thinks we should really know that are related to emergency management. And then lastly, she is an author of a new book about disasters and climate change entitled Disasterology, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Climate Crisis. The book's going to be published come this August by HarperCollins. I have already bought mine. I suggest that you all do the same, because I think she has a lot of interesting things to tell us and lots of things that we can learn from her. So let's start with our first question for Dr. Montano. Tell us a little bit about why and how you became involved with the field of emergency management and how that led to the study of disasters and this field that you now call disasterology.
Yeah, so I lived in New Orleans post-Katrina for several years. I was there working on disaster recovery through a variety of nonprofits in the city. So I was doing everything from, you know, physically rebuilding homes to helping homeowners fill out insurance paperwork to doing a lot of volunteer coordinating of other volunteers that were coming down to the city to help. And so that was kind of my first foray into the world of disasters. While I was living in New Orleans, the BP oil disaster happened along the coast. And some of the environmental groups I was working with in the city kind of temporarily dropped everything there to go down to coastal Louisiana to help with the response and recovery from the oil spill. I also, around that time, had the opportunity to go to Joplin, Missouri, following their major tornado and do some recovery work there. And as I kind of started to go to these other places that had, you know, experienced relatively different disasters than New Orleans had with Katrina, you know, geographically very different places, culturally different places, I was noticing that there were actually a lot of commonalities in terms of how people were really struggling through those recoveries. You know, there was a persistent lack of resources, a lack of communication, a lack of coordination. And so I started to kind of realize that some of those problems with recovery that I had assumed were pretty unique to New Orleans were actually more systemic to the U.S. approach to disaster recovery. And so that realization kind of led me on a journey to graduate school as I realized I needed kind of more of a formal education in emergency management and disasters more broadly in order to really be able to think about solutions of, you know, how we might change things for the better.
That's wonderful. To be attracted to that field of study is unique, I have to say. most people tend to run away from disasters and you go towards them. And I think right off the top, that makes you, you know, rather unusual and somewhat interesting because, you know, this is an area that not a lot of people do want to spend time on. And as I said, most people tend to want to run away. And one of the things I find is that the term disaster gets used to describe almost any kind of a terrible event, you know, these days, from crop failures to things like, you know, Winter Storm Uri that we just went through. And, you know, I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, what's the difference between, you know, an emergency, a disaster, and a catastrophe from a scientific perspective? Because I know these things are different. And I was wondering if you could share with us how you see that and how we should think about those in some kind of context.
Yeah. So, you know, as you pointed out, we all kind of use the term disaster pretty generically to describe any bad thing that happens. But from a research perspective and from a more scientific perspective, there, you know, are distinctions between different types of events. I like to say not every disaster is a disaster. Some are actually emergencies and some are kind of on the higher end of things and are catastrophes. So disaster researchers dating back many decades developed what we call the hazard event classification, which I will like spare you the theoretical details of, but essentially what it is getting at is that there's kind of a spectrum of events that can happen. You have emergencies on the lower end. That would be something like a large apartment fire, a mass shooting, something that it is still a crisis that requires a response, but it is managed kind of on a more local level using more local resources. Yep. In the middle, you have a disaster. This would be, you know, the Joplin tornado, the BP oil disaster, Sandy. These are events that can be, you know, really significant, bring a community to a standstill. By definition, they require help coming in from the outside. It overwhelms that local community. But it is, you know, something that is kind of still ultimately at the end of the day, relatively manageable. And then we have catastrophes on the high end. So in the U.S. context, that would be Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure, Hurricane Maria, you know, these events that come with really significant death tolls that, you know, to the point where local leadership is completely ineffectual and you're needing to bring in leadership from the outside. Resources are needing to come in not only from the federal level, but also potentially internationally. You know, they're the kinds of events that kind of stand apart and stand on their own. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, people might feel like we're kind of mincing words here, but this is actually really important from an emergency management perspective, because you know, the way we manage an emergency at that local level is going to look very different than how we manage a catastrophe, the way we plan for that, the resources that we need, who is going to be involved in that. That is all different kind of from one event to another. So it actually is a really important distinction.
Sure. Sure. No, that was very helpful because as I say, and you stated as well, everybody uses that term, but I don't know that they really put it in the right context or understand. And I think that, you know, things can certainly move from a disaster to a catastrophe. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So, you know, If you use Hurricane Katrina for an example, you know, the actual storm of Katrina itself as it comes through New Orleans caused damage, obviously caused significant damage along the coast of Mississippi and southeast Louisiana. But for the city of New Orleans itself, relatively minimal damage. Of course, it was later as the levees started to break and the city you know, disappears under 80% of the city disappears underwater, that you start moving from disaster to that catastrophe category as communications mm-hmm. completely fail, as, you know, the response falters. And so certainly, you know, disasters have that potential to kind of move up in category.
Sure. Well, you talk about Katrina and you know, reading about your background and listening to you about the experiences and the places that you've been, you know, obviously you've seen disaster in all different sizes, shapes, and forms. But I think also you've had the chance to experience different forms of climate change. And I'm kind of wondering, what would you say is kind of climate change's role in kind of creating disasters? And to what extent, you know, is this relationship, if there is one, preventable?
Yeah. So the kind of connection here between climate and disasters is that as the climate is changing, the hazards that can lead to disasters are changing. So, you know, we're seeing changes to hurricanes. We're seeing, you know, changes to spring river flooding. We're seeing changes to winter weather, to summer weather, to heat waves and cold waves. Sea level rise, of course, is, you know, leading to increased flooding. So, you know, the hazards themselves that we're experiencing related to climate change aren't necessarily new, right? We've always had to deal with hurricanes, but the way those hazards behave and kind of when and how and to what extent they impact us is changing. So climate change is one factor among many that leads to a disaster. You know, other factors like development, how and where we're building, you know, our kind of interconnectedness of systems, right? There's all these other factors, you know, vulnerability, that is social vulnerability, economic vulnerability, that is at play there. But climate change kind of in and of itself is certainly contributing to those changing hazards. In terms of, you know, kind of where that leaves us with how can we prevent this from happening or what can we do? Certainly mitigating climate change itself is incredibly important. We also do need to contend with the reality that we are already experiencing the consequences of climate change. You know, still early days, but we are experiencing it. And, you know, even if we stopped drilling up oil tomorrow, we're still locked into a certain amount of change. And so that means we need to adapt. We need to, you know, undertake efforts to protect ourselves and our communities from this increasing risk and until we can kind of get a better control over climate change as a whole.
Yeah, no, I totally subscribe to that. I think that, you know, the idea of prevention is something that is an ingredient that, you know, is definitely recognized in the aftermath of situations, you know, just like we faced here at the winter storm recently. And you know, that means that maybe climate change, well, in some way is natural in the sense of the disaster that it kind of, you know, it triggers. But what you're saying, it seems to me, is that natural disasters are truly not necessarily natural or just acts of God, right?
Right, exactly. You know, those factors I just listed, whether it's climate change or, you know, infrastructure maintenance or our interconnected systems or development, you know, those aren't natural decisions, right? Those are products of human decisions. So no, disasters are not natural. That's kind of a misnomer that we use. Certainly, you know, not acts of God. Dr. Dennis Mulledy, who's one of one of our famous disaster researchers, he used to say that disasters are by design. They're created. They're a choice. Very often they're policy decisions that have been made. So, you know, and again, this isn't, you know, just kind of an issue of semantics. There's real implications here, right? If human decisions are at the root of disasters happening, then that's actually good news, because that means we can change our decisions that we're making and do more to minimize or prevent these events from happening.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people look at these disasters and say, well, it's all, you know, environmentally charged and connected. And then you turn around and said, no, it's really governance. It's really important here. And here's why, because if we had mitigated, you know, this and looked ahead and perhaps put some policy in place to prevent this, you know, this kind of enormous, you know, kind of event, and control it, perhaps, you know, we would have come out the other side better than we had.
In your experience, Dr. Montano, do you think that municipalities are adequately preparing for future climate risk as climate changes? Or are we continuing to look in the rearview mirror at what's happened previously? You know, Texas, we're very familiar with droughts and heat events and floods, but we did not see the storm Uri coming in the slightest bit, because we have a backward-looking bias at this point. Do you, in your experience, do you see that municipalities are starting to kind of look ahead at what these future climate risks could be when they're preparing for these disasters?
So I think the kind of short answer here is no. Generally, municipalities aren't doing enough to prepare for climate. What I'll say from an emergency management perspective is that, you know, one of the key responsibilities of emergency managers is to do risk assessments for their locality. That involves doing a hazard assessment that looks at the types of hazards their community may experience. It also involves like a vulnerability assessment to assess kind of how vulnerable they are to those various hazards and which parts of their community are most at risk. And in what we've seen is that kind of traditionally, those hazard assessments in many places have kind of been built off of the historic disasters that have happened in that community. You know, if you say, well, 20 years ago we flooded, so we know flooding is a risk that we should plan for. The one problem with doing that is specifically related to climate change, which is, of course, these hazards are changing. And so we really do need to be looking forward for those hazard assessments and incorporating climate change projections into those assessments. And that is something that, you know, some communities are doing or are trying to do. Some communities don't really have the resources or the knowledge or technical expertise to really be able to do that. So there is some pretty serious kind of variation around the country in terms of that. But, you know, to connect this back to what I said earlier about this distinction between emergencies, disasters, and catastrophes, you know, one of the ways that we can try to minimize how severe an event is by doing preparedness efforts, of doing more mitigation efforts in communities to minimize that risk. So, you know, a flood that may have been a disaster, if you've done a lot to mitigate that risk, may only be an emergency. And so that's where you can kind of, if not prevent that disaster from happening altogether, you can at least minimize the kind of severity of it.
Okay. One of the databases that we use to evaluate our municipal credits from a client perspective, a climate perspective, we use the term climate resiliency, which is a combination of what we determine as a risk and readiness. We use the database of the Notre Dame Gaines Urban Adaptation Assessment. The biggest factor in a municipality's climate risk within that database is population density. One of the biggest factors in their climate readiness is their bond worthiness, which is essentially their fiscal health. So it sounds like it kind of lends to what you're talking about and how they plan their urban population, how their density builds up, and also how they're able to maintain their financial flexibility to adapt to these future events. So kind of my next question would be, what other factors do you think could play a part in either their overall risk or readiness for municipality that they should be considering?
Yeah, so, you know, these questions of kind of coming up with indexes for vulnerability, resilience, readiness is something that disaster researchers have spent a lot of time working on. One issue that I think is important to kind of recognize off the top is just that there is very often a disagreement about what those terms actually mean, and kind of different people use the term resilience in different ways. So I think as a starting place, it's really important to kind of define what you kind of mean by that term. From an emergency management perspective, when I'm thinking about resilience and thinking about factors that I would want to see at a local level that would indicate a level of resilience, I'm thinking about this in terms of how they're doing emergency management. So there's kind of four phases in emergency management. We have hazard mitigation, those things you're doing to prevent the disaster from happening. We have preparedness, the things you're doing to ready yourself to respond to and recover from a disaster if it happens. You have response, which is your actual responding to the disaster. And then you have the recovery afterwards, rebuilding a community, putting everything back together. So when I'm thinking about kind of the resilience of a community and how they could prevent a shock or a disaster from happening, and then also come back from that if it does happen, I'm thinking about those four different phases, and I'm asking, you know, kind of going down a little mental checklist of saying, you know, has this community done mitigation? Have they, are they basing their mitigation off of the hazards that they are actually most at risk from? Have they correctly identified those hazards and those risks? When I'm thinking about preparedness, I'm thinking, have they done response planning, but have they also started planning ahead for a recovery? Are they working on preparing the nonprofits in their communities, the businesses in their communities, individuals in their community for a disaster, right? Not just what they're doing to prepare government, but the, as FEMA calls it, the whole community. In response, you know, you're looking at kind of what response organizations there are, kind of the level of volunteerism and level of service in your community. We know volunteers and nonprofits are a hugely important piece of how effectively a response can go. When you get to recovery, again, you're looking, has that community done anything ahead of time to plan for recovery? Do they have kind of the internal infrastructure set up to have a recovery committee who is going to oversee that recovery committee or oversee that recovery? Do they have, you know, enough people working in their emergency management agency to apply for those recovery grants? So there's kind of an endless list of factors that you're looking at. I don't necessarily think there's any like comprehensive list of factors, but certainly there's, you know, different kind of indicators that you can look towards to see how seriously a community is taking their risk right. And, you know, how, you know, what it is they're doing to try and minimize that risk.
Yeah, preparedness really is, as you say, how dependent are we on others to essentially pull us out of the pickle that we may find ourselves in is the question that has to be asked. You know, one of the things we found here is there are actually two different types of Texas. There's the rural Texas, where people do have fireplaces and people have the ability to, you know, essentially, you know, find habitats that they can survive in if something like this occurs, and they have access to food and water in different ways. But if you find yourself in the urban Texas, which is, you know, again, when you look at San Antonio and you look at Dallas and Houston and Austin, those are four of the 10 largest cities in America that are largely cities. And so there is no such thing as a fireplace in lower income housing, for instance. And so what happens when everything goes down for them? They can't just go running out and just, you know, find wood and pop it into the fireplace and grab a bunch of blankets. So here again, I think that there's a disproportionate impact that comes from lack of preparedness. And do you see that happening in other communities as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So a kind of myth that we have about disasters is that they are these great equalizers and that everybody is affected equally by disasters. And in reality, that is not the case at all. We see pretty consistently across various types of events that there are disproportionate impacts. People mm-hmm. who are low income, communities of color, women even tend to experience more impacts than others. We mm-hmm. also see that there are inequalities in how different groups of people are able to access help when a disaster happens. So, obviously a group like undocumented immigrants are going to have a much more difficult time accessing government-based assistance.
Sure.
We also see the way, recovery policies are written, the way grant programs are written within FEMA and the federal government more broadly. They tend to favor communities that have a more robust emergency management agency who has the staff to be applying for those grants to bring more money into that community. So there's all different kinds of kind of systemic inequalities built into our emergency management system mm-hmm. that can even kind of further compound those various sure. impacts.
Sure. Well, even to take it a step further, the aftermath of this, certainly from a Texas perspective is, Now we're trying to assign blame, but who's going to pay for this and how does it get paid mm-hmm. for? And so the impact, the ripple out effect of this in terms of low income, disadvantaged communities is going to be extraordinarily extended because their bills are going up and the cost of power to them is not going to get subsidized.
What I found interesting mm-hmm. about this Texas disaster, though, is we had a saying in one of my previous iterations of careers that, mobility and ability were big driving factors. And typically in Texas, at least in Texas, the ability to weather, let's say, a hurricane or a drought and the mobility to get out of the way of a hurricane or a drought are two huge factors and to be able to withstand that type of climate risk. And the interesting thing about Uri was it paralyzed our ability to withstand the cold. And it absolutely paralyzed our mobility to get out of the way of it because of the ice storms and nobody having any ability to travel. Where are you going to go if you're in Austin? You're going to go to Houston? No. Are you going to go to Dallas? No. You can't travel on the roads because the roads are impassable and you can't heat your house because your entire house is full of electronic appliances from heaters to water heaters to ovens. And so mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned a great equalizer, and in this case, it actually kind of was a great equalizer because it paralyzed the entire community's ability to do anything about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another good point, too, is that one of the defaults of how we think about disasters tends to be evacuate, especially in communities that experience hurricanes. Our kind of default reaction to experiencing a hazard is kind of get out, get away from it. And that's logical to a large extent, too. But another thing that I think we need to think about for our larger cities and also as it relates to hazards changing because of climate change is that evacuation is not always an option. And I think sometimes communities tend to have an over-reliance on, our solution to the problem is going to be to evacuate, when really staying home, sheltering in place is very often, if not the better option, is kind of a necessary reaction based on the constraints of the situation. As you were explaining, people, not being able to go onto the roads, doing any kind of, traditional evacuation isn't possible in that kind of scenario. So mm-hmm. one of the kind of things that I think some local communities need to do more of is, expanding those shelter in place orders, thinking more about communication with individuals and households when those kinds of situations come to fruition. But, even for bigger events like hurricanes, I mean, there are a lot of reasons the city of Houston was not evacuated during Harvey. As we saw during Rita, you know, a mass evacuation of a city like Houston does not necessarily go well.
Well, the other thing too, which I don't want to forget about, that really was kind of the cherry on top. And as we talk about evacuation and sheltering in place and finding kind of support, is this notion that we're living in a pandemic. And so, you know, the risk of infection and being in very close in quarters in public shelters and various other things, for many was just out of the question. Talk a little bit about the impact of the pandemic and disaster management. You know, that was a whole different twist to this one as far as we were concerned.
Yeah, threw in a little bit of a wild card there. So kind of from the moment a year ago that I think many of us had a fuller realization of how significant the pandemic was going to be in the United States, one of the biggest concerns among emergency management officials and experts was, what does this mean for responding to the other disasters that we know will happen in the next year plus? And one of the very first things that FEMA did last year was issue new guidances for last year's hurricane season that kind of gave instructions to local communities about, you know, how they needed to adapt sheltering plans, evacuation plans, kind of what the protocols were going to be in terms of, do you prioritize hurricane response? Do you prioritize COVID response? And, you know, that's been applicable to tornadoes that have happened, other flood events, to Uri, certainly. And, you know, we've definitely seen that the pandemic has affected how emergency managers respond. You know, the things that need to happen during a disaster response very often involve people being in close proximity to one another. So it certainly kind of made everything slightly more difficult at every turn. Unfortunately don't have research yet to see exactly if there were spikes in communities that needed to do community sheltering. So we don't have great data on that yet. But it certainly has affected everything operationally and long-term too, as communities are going through the recovery process from various other disasters to, try to account for COVID restrictions as you're doing that. Again, sure. It complicates everything.
Sure. Well, I have one last question that I'd like to touch on before we, you know, bring this wonderful discussion to a close, and that is the role of communication. And, you know, it's, you know, one of the things that was said about what we experienced down here is that they didn't really tell us. I really didn't have an appreciation for what was coming at us. I wasn't really aware where to go. You know, it seems to me that communication is a very pivotal role in disaster management and emergency management. You know, what can you tell us about things that we should be thinking about and what governments should be doing in recognizing the importance of that?
Yeah, communication is, you know, absolutely huge in disasters. It's something that emergency managers spend a significant amount of their time working on. But I think maybe the easiest answer here is that communicating with the public in the middle of a crisis can be really difficult. Can be, you know, logistical barriers, if communication networks are down where people aren't getting messages. So you have to kind of contend with that. But you also have to contend with this issue of information changing very quickly. You have to contend with an issue of, you know, different communities, different people needing different pieces of information. And you have to deal with things like language barriers. You have to deal with issues like trust, who a message is coming from, what that message says, what those recommendations are all going to influence how different people react to those messages. The consistency of those messages, all of those different factors are playing into whether or not people take those warnings seriously. On top of that, just base level communication that has to happen, though, you also need to be giving recommendations to people that mm-hmm. they actually have the ability to act on. If you are, you know, telling people that they need to stay home and they can't leave their house for the next 3 days because the roads are icy, but they haven't had the opportunity to go to the grocery store to get mm-hmm. food for those 3 days, then there's going to be a disconnect there. So, you know, getting the timing, the information, getting those warnings and explanations to the public is a really complicated process. It's something we have to do and emergency management needs to be better at. And again, as we move forward into the future and we see various risks increase, it only becomes more important.
Sure. You know, down in here in Texas, I think about the only communication that we got for the storm that we just went through was, watch out.
Yeah.
And not much else. So
I was going to say, but, Dr. Montani, on your blog, you have a holiday gift recommendation guide. I was wondering if you'd be able to sit down with us and put together a 2022 Christmas guide for Texans who are stuck in a cold storm, you know, at least from a Maine perspective. You know, what do we need when temperatures hit six? You know,
yeah,
exactly. It'd be good to have
a generator.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
That's the trick.
Yeah, generator.
All right. Well, Dr. Samantha Montano, this has been wonderful. We appreciate your time, your insights, and I think we've learned a thing or two about disasters today, and I hope our listeners will become avid subscribers to your newsletter and your blog, Disasterology. And by all means, I encourage everybody to purchase a copy of her wonderful book that's coming out this summer. I think that, you know, there one thing for sure, that there will be more disasters to come. And I hope after our discussion today that we're all going to think a little bit more about, am I ready? And who can I help, and how can I get through this disaster that's coming at us? So thank you again, and please stay tuned for our next edition, our next chapter of The Hitchhiker's Guide to ESG. Have a good day.
Sage Advisory Services is a registered investment advisor that provides investment management services for a variety of institutions and high net worth individuals. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended as investment advice or an offer or solicitation with respect to the purchase or sale of any security, strategy, or an investment product. Investors should make their own decisions on investment strategies based on their specific investment objectives and financial circumstances. All investments contain risk and may lose value. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. For additional information on Sage and its investment management services, please view our website at www.sageadvisory.com or refer to our form ADV, which is available upon request by calling 512-327-5530.